Before we get into today's podcast, I want to offer you a powerful free resource. We often hear from listeners looking for answers to those who claim God cannot exist for a variety of scientific reasons. But science actually supports the existence of God, which is why I want to offer you a free download called God's Not Dead. It explores scientifically how our own cosmos points to a creator in three clear areas. Again, this powerful resource is yours absolutely free, so why not download God's Not Dead for free right now at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, here's today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we are returning to the troubling, concerning, tragic story which we covered in an episode last year, you might remember, of Lucy Letby. Before we go any further, it's worth flagging up at the start. This is a story about a nurse, a pediatric nurse, who has been convicted of murdering seven babies in her care. It's a story that touches, obviously, on it's a very sensitive topic. So we just want to make people aware that we're going to be going over some of the developments in that story and some of the bigger implications for us as believers as well. But I'm sure you remember it quite well, Dad, but to briefly summarize the Lucy Letby story, as we were told in kind of summer of last year, 2023, was after she was convicted of murdering seven children on a small neonatal unit that she worked at in Chester in the north of England.
Yeah, I mean, for me as a neonatologist, you know, working very closely with other colleagues on a big neonatal intensive care unit in London, this is a kind of an ultimate horror possibility. The idea that somebody very popular, apparently highly competent, neonatal nurse, trusted, loved by parents and families and staff, you know, that actually there's a whole different story, and that that for some bizarre and unknown psychological reason, she is, when alone and unsupervised, harming babies in her care to such an extent that a significant number of the babies suddenly collapse. Some of them are resuscitated, during which Lucy Letby was part of the process of helping to resuscitate them. But then tragically, some of them died. These unexpected incidents happened so frequently, and only when Lucy Letby was present, that eventually some of the neonatologists, the doctors there, became increasingly worried about the connection between Lucy Letby and these sudden collapses.
That's right. And the story, as we kind of had it presented to us after the trial completed, and there was obviously kind of reams of coverage, was that over several years, gradually some of the doctors working in that same unit began to suspect that Letby was the one common thread between all of these sudden collapses of children. They noticed this sharp spike in both deaths and kind of children having serious incidents on the relatively small unit. And they noticed that Letby was the only common nurse or staff member on duty for all of these collapses.
They constructed a famous chart, didn't they, which appeared...
Yes, that's right, yeah. Which kind of
crosses,
was a kind of
crosses
of who was there and the single person who was present for every single one of the children, highlighted in purple on a famous chart that was distributed by the police and shown to the jury was Lucy Letby.
But it was more than that, in the sense that it wasn't just that she happened to be on duty but was working, you know, in a different part of the unit. It was the fact that she was actually there at the time that the baby collapsed. She was physically caring for the child.
That's right. And for those who aren't familiar, you know, slightly unusually, a neonatal ward, as I understand, is normally kind of individual rooms, one for each child and one nurse assigned per child. So they have quite a degree of oversight. They're not kind of moving around constantly, but you know, if Letby is assigned to child A for a night shift, you know, she will have hours and hours unsupervised in a quiet room with no one looking over her shoulder with the child. And the accusation that she was convicted on was that through a variety of methods, she had deliberately harmed them. So sometimes she was accused of deliberately injecting insulin into their feeding bags and giving them a massive overdose of insulin. Sometimes it was injecting air into their breathing tubes, I think, or feeding tubes into the vein.
Sometimes into the feeding tubes, sometimes directly into a vein to create what's called an air embolus.
Yeah, and that kind of blocks blood flow and can cause a very sudden traumatic death as well. And so she's convicted, and this kind of horror sweeps the nation. You know, she's described as Britain's worst child serial killer of all time. You know, there's these reams of coverage about, you know, why wasn't the warnings from the doctors listened to earlier? Could we have saved lives if she had been taken off duty? Because once she is eventually moved off the ward, the deaths suddenly mysteriously stop happening. And it's seen as a kind of a big scandal. I think there's been an inquiry ordered. And it all starts to go quiet. And you know, we did an episode about tragedies and psychopaths in hospitals and that kind of thing. But then it all starts to go quiet. But what I hadn't appreciated is that there is a small but growing movement of dissenting voices that start to arise. That people, both who've been following from overseas, but also a small but significant list of kind of local medical scientific experts here in the UK who have been reading about the case start to question some of the evidence that was used in convicting Letby and start to say, hang on, we're not so convinced she might be guilty after all.
That's right. And of course, what makes the case so troubling was that she was convicted of murder on a large number of cases, but entirely on circumstantial evidence. In no case was there the smoking gun, you know, the absolute uncontrovertible evidence that she was watched doing something completely inappropriate. So it was entirely based on circumstantial evidence. And then the question comes, well, you know, is it possible that there's been a terrible miscarriage of justice here, that she genuinely was a caring nurse who was very unfortunately happened to be present when babies collapsed just for entirely natural reasons.
And as this is happening and kind of gathering online in particular, there is a sudden kind of deep freeze on discussion in the UK because a retrial, the jury was unable to come to a verdict on one of the counts that she was charged with of murder. And so the judge ordered a retrial with a new jury. And when that got underway, Britain's very strict contempt of court laws kicked in, which prevent any reporting or publication of evidence and issues that arose in the first trial, because that might prejudice the jury in this new trial, as they are supposed to only be considering the evidence that is given to them in court and not kind of have their minds swayed by what they're reading elsewhere. And so you have this slightly strange thing where, you know, after the initial conviction, there's a blaze of publicity and reams of detailed reporting on it. And then it suddenly all goes quiet again, just as this kind of doubts about the strength of her conviction, the safety of her conviction are growing.
That's right. And the process, again, and neither of us are lawyers, so we're having to give an outsider's opinion of what seems to have happened, but it seems that following a British jury trial, if a jury has agreed on a verdict of guilty, it is possible to appeal the verdict, but you have to demonstrate that there has been some miscarriage of justice. It's not good enough to say, well, the jury made a mistake and I want to go back and have another jury. So the only grounds on which you can appeal the verdict is that there was a miscarriage of justice, and in particular that the judge handled the case inappropriately. In what evidence was allowed, what evidence was disallowed, and in particular how the judge then directs the jury before the jurors go off and have to come to a conclusion alone.
Hmm. And this is what Letby does earlier this year, 2024, is she instructs her lawyers to ask for permission to appeal on five grounds, a mixture of things about how the judge handled expert witness testimony and how the judge refused various submissions that her own lawyers had made during the trial, and how the judge gave wrong directions to the jury. So, for instance, one of the grounds she sought to appeal was that the judge was wrong to tell the jury that they did not have to be sure of the precise harmful act or acts on any given count. So this is a kind of came up in the trial, is that on some of the babies, the prosecution couldn't say for sure. We're not entirely sure how we think that she killed this baby, but we're very sure that it could only have been her who did it. The judge basically told the jury, you can still convict someone of murder, even if you're not sure on the exact method they used. If you're sure that they were the person who did it, you can still convict. So there's a number of kind of complex legal grounds that she sought to appeal. But this was all, and this happened in, there was a hearing in April before three judges, where the same legal teams from prosecution and defense came together again in a court in London, I imagine, and kind of hashed out the arguments to and fro. The three appeal judges ultimately delivered a ruling, but because it was happening simultaneously with the retrial on the count that the jury couldn't agree on, they weren't able to release this ruling publicly. There were restrictions placed on reporting on it, so we didn't know about it, in order to not kind of, again, prejudice the jury in the other trial and to keep to Britain's very strict contempt of court laws.
Yes, but the judgment from the appeal, the three appeal judges, is now available and in the public domain. And it's a very long and impressive document. It's 58 pages of very closely detailed arguments, in which each of the individual cases is then analysed again in detail. The evidence for and against is analysed, the evidence that was given in the original trial, and so on. And we've skimmed this document, which is available. We'll put the links in the notes. But what's your impression, Tim, having seen this process in action?
Yeah, I mean, it's, again, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a doctor, so I have limited ability to kind of assess how right they are. But when you read the detail and the depth of what these three judges have gone through, I mean, I guess the context for this is that in throughout this process, as we mentioned, this kind of pro-Letby, for lack of a better word, or at least people who are worried that she may not be guilty, movement has kind of culminated in a famously long 13,000 word article in the New Yorker, a very prominent American magazine, which kind of suggests or heavily implies that she is the victim of a miscarriage of justice and she didn't do it, and goes in great detail speaking to lots of different people about supposed problems with the original trial and some of the evidence the prosecution came up. But because this came out during the middle of her retrial, it couldn't be published in the UK. So it was actually, the New Yorker actually blocked UK. To this day, they blocked UK IP addresses from accessing it. But obviously, you know, it's 2024. People don't find it too difficult to work around that. So you have this kind of awkward juxtaposition of people. There is this kind of secret New Yorker article that you have to have a special workaround to read that the establishment don't want you to read, and that contributes to kind of conspiracy theorizing that, you know, Letby has been railroaded, and she's actually innocent.
So can we just sort of just take an aside then, because this is a sort of interesting side point here, and that is about the laws, quite draconian laws there are in the UK on reporting restrictions, aren't there? When a trial is actually underway, a jury trial.
Even before
in
then,
the UK, that,
even before sorry? Then, when a case is active under the Contempt of Court Act 1982, I was trained in this fastidiously in my journalism training because okay. it's very important because it's actually a misconception. It's even before the once a case is active, which is normally when a person is arrested, or possibly charged. There are very strict limitations on what you can say about that person and the thing that of which they have been accused, so that when it, if and when it does come to trial, the jury don't arrive having already had their minds made up. So there is literally a list of like seven things you can say: the name of the person, their age, where they live. You can say what they've been charged with, and that's why sometimes even on quite famous stories you might read. You know, on the BBC News website about a kind of high profile person who's been arrested and charged of a very famous crime, that it's surprisingly sparse. It just says, you know, so-and-so age 55 of this street in this city was arrested and charged with this thing. They're next due in court on this date. And the reason they can't say, you know, neighbors were alerted when they saw a bloodstained corpse scattered, you know, they can't give any of that color because it's, that might come up as evidence in trial. And so there are very strict rules so that when the jury comes to it, they can't have read anything that might have prejudiced them. And then that that lasts from the moment of charge all the way through to conviction or, you know, if they're if they win the case and they're found not guilty. And that point, you know, there's no, the jury is disempaneled and then is free rein to write and say whatever you want. But once the case is active, as it was when Letby got her retrial, suddenly these restrictions clamp down again, and there is nothing that UK-based publications can really say apart from dry, neutral statements of fact.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting because I've actually been a juror on one occasion, and I've acted as an expert witness in a number of jury trials. And it is interesting to, you know, to see British justice in action, you know, in the courtroom. And one of the things is you are told very firmly as a juror is that you may have read things in newspapers about this case. You may have been aware of things. You are to put all of those things completely out of your mind. You are to disregard anything you know. It is only evidence that is given in this court that you must take into account. You mustn't go looking for it anywhere else. You mustn't go onto the internet to seek information. Only evidence that is presented in court is allowed to be taken into account when you come to a decision.
Yeah. And there have, and as the internet age has unfolded, these restrictions have become increasingly under strain because, as we discussed, you know, the New Yorker US-based publication is not bound by the UK's contempt of court laws. And so it's historically, you know, you'd have to jump on a steamboat and travel across the Atlantic to read it. But now anyone based in the UK with a click of their mouse find their way, if they know how, to read this potentially prejudicial material. But also for jurors themselves, they're now having to be given these very lengthy, stern warnings because there have been several cases where a juror has gone home after the first day of a trial and thought, I wonder if I'll just Google this person's name and gosh, they found out that they've got these previous convictions that they weren't supposed to know about. Or even in worse instances, sometimes they've sought to contact family members of the defendant on Facebook and say, I'm in your brother's trial, but don't worry, I think he's innocent and I'll get him off and and stuff like this. And there have even been some extreme examples where jurors have actually been imprisoned for breaking these very strict rules about contempt of court. So it's taken very seriously in an effort to kind of protect the integrity of the trial system, but it's fair to say it's coming under a lot of strain in the modern era because it's so much easier now to find out information, to contact people, than it ever was before.
It is, but I must say I think the attempt and the reason for doing it is very honourable. It's not in any way to try to subvert justice. It's to try to make sure that it is fair, that the process that is taking place within the courtroom is fair and is according to the rules. And, you know, there are quite strict rules about some evidence is admissible, some evidence that can be held within the court. But things that are tittle-tattle, hearsay, you know, not validated, this is not evidence and it cannot be brought into the courtroom. And so because of the ongoing trial of one case of that
the retrial.
Lucy Letby was involved in, therefore information could not be released.
And so we, as the kind of watching public, were ignorant of this appeal court ruling by the three judges in April until later in the summer, in July, when it was finally released after the retrial had completed, which ended up convicting her on that extra count. And so now suddenly we can read finally a kind of counter narrative, because I guess the vacuum was filled by the New Yorker and by these kind of dissenting voices saying, oh, I think Letby is a victim of a miscarriage of justice. And, you know, I skimmed it and I found some of their arguments interesting. You know, these weren't just cranks. These are practicing consultant neonatologists saying, I don't think she could have killed someone that way. And there are prominent statisticians saying, I think the famous char of, you know, Letby is the only person whose name is crossed on every single child when they died is misleading and fallacious for these reasons. And but actually, when you go and you see the appeal court judgment, you realize that all of these arguments were raised by the defense in their attempt to appeal, both sometimes in the original court and in the appeal. And they've been meticulously worked through by the three judges, who ultimately concluded that, yes, the conviction is safe. There were no legal grounds for appeal. The judge did not do anything wrong. And the jury were kind of properly directed.
And I think, you know, the temptation, and I speak of myself, I've in the past, you know, when I was working as a paediatrician, I was occasionally rung up by journalists and said, you know, would you make some comments about this case? What do you think about this or about this issue or this? And there's a great temptation to just, you know, give an off the cuff response and say, well, I've read about it. And to be honest, I'm really quite concerned about this. And then, of course, the journalist says, well, you know, a senior paediatrician has now expressed doubts. And whereas what I know is that when you're actually instructed as an expert witness, the way that it operates is extremely detailed. And, you know, and I do act as an expert witness in cases, no longer in criminal cases, but I do still act as an expert witness in civil cases. When you're instructed as an independent expert, first of all, there's very strong, even draconian warnings that you are there to act for the benefit of the court and not on any one side. You're not an advocate. You're not there to put forward, plead someone's case. That's the job of the barrister. Your job is to give an independent opinion for the court on the matters that are within your area of expertise, and you're then expected to go through the medical records in this case with an extraordinarily fine tooth comb. You could literally spend 8, 10, 12 hours going through every single piece of paper, and often medical records run into thousands and thousands of sheets, and checking each one. And so therefore, for instance, in this case, working out exactly what fluids were given to the baby, who signed up the prescription, you know, what were the timings, when did the baby collapse, what was the evidence during the resuscitation, all that is gone through in great detail. And
how long does synthetic insulin take to disappear from a blood test? And, you know, there's a lot of medical arguing about, you know, was the insulin present in these babies' bloods? Could it have appeared naturally, or was it introduced artificially? And some of it got very complex, didn't it?
It did. And it's one of the very strange things in this whole trial was that there were a whole series of collapses, some of which sadly died in the death of the baby, some in which the baby survived. And these are all listed in the Court of Appeal report judgment. And some of them were air embolus, some of them were insulin poisoning, some were accused of overfeeding with milk, injury to the liver. And but in particular, I think the ones that where the insulin poisoning was being claimed, there was apparently uncontrovertible evidence that insulin had been added into the bags, intravenous fluid bags that at least one and maybe two babies were receiving. And at court, as it was discussed, it was basically accepted by the defence that that must have been done malevolently. Somebody had deliberately put insulin into an intravenous fluid with the intention to cause harm to a baby. And so then the question was, well, then if it wasn't Lucy Letby, who was it?
Yeah, could there have been two child serial killers working on the same small neonatal intensive care unit at the same time?
And so when you see evidence, you know, you just see all the evidence stacking up one by one, you can see how even though in any one particular case, you could say, well, you know, is it really the case? When the jury have sat through all the evidence and they're then asked to say, you know, beyond reasonable doubt, did Lucy Letby attempt to kill or did actually kill these babies? And they came to the conclusion, beyond reasonable doubt, she did.
And I think, it's not going to make the dissenters kind of go away, but it's been interesting how, you know, earlier in the summer, there was kind of a surge of interest. There was following the New Yorker one, there was actually a lengthy Guardian article in which they kind of poured through the different reasons that people are casting doubt on it. It didn't come down on the side as strongly as the New Yorker did, but kind of, you know, showed that these are not just fantasists and crackpots. These are serious, credible people who have serious, credible reasons. And in fact, one of the things that was most interesting to me is that people pointed to previous cases, a neonatal nurse in the Netherlands called Lucia de Burke and another nurse in Italy called Daniela Poggiali, who were both convicted in large part because of kind of similar statistical coincidence of murdering their patients. There was an emeritus professor of statistics that's kind of suggesting that actually these shift charts that kind of are supposedly the smoking gun are actually very often misused and misunderstood by prosecution and police. And there have been other cases where, you know, nurses have actually been shown to be innocent, having previously been convicted. So there was kind of reasonable question to doubt. And then I think the release of the appeal court ruling has kind of swung it back the other way. And people are like, okay, the British justice system did look at all these concerns. They weren't ignorant of what people were raising worries about. They worked through it piece by piece, painstakingly, and they concluded that this conviction is still safe and she did do it.
Did you know that this month marks the fourth anniversary of Premier Insight, the ministry that brings you this podcast? While it's a real season of celebration, there's also a very real financial challenge that must be met this month. Due to rising costs and the pressure of inflation, there's a $35,000 gap that must be closed this month to keep Premier Insight moving forward with strength. So that's why I'm asking you to give a special anniversary gift to keep programs like this podcast on the air and equip a generation of Christians to live out their faith with clarity, conviction, and confidence. Simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
I must say, overall, you know, as somebody who's watched the British justice system at close quarters, you know, as an observer, as an expert witness, and as a juror, overall, I am really almost surprisingly supportive of the process. I think that it's very slow and it's very inefficient. And at times incredibly cumbersome. But in the end, I think as a system involving flawed human beings who are genuinely trying their best, who don't have a whole load of preconceived opinions, but are simply trying to take each case on its merits and try and work out what actually happened and who was responsible. My impression is that by and large, the court system in the UK works pretty well. The judges take their responsibilities extremely seriously. They pay a lot of energy and attention into trying to do the right thing. The barristers on both sides are often, you know, highly experienced and competent, and again, take a great deal of care to try and follow the rules and yet give their clients the very best chance of success. So yes, it's a flawed system, and no doubt there are miscarriages of justice. We know that there are, but I think it is, in my opinion, a pretty good. I personally, if I was convicted of some horrible crime, would feel that I had the best chance of justice in a British court as I probably had anywhere in the world.
What I find interesting is, you know, you mentioned the role of the expert witness there. You know, you're hired by either the defence or the prosecution, and that kind of strikes at the fundamentally, it's called an adversarial justice system we have here in England and Wales in particular, but the UK. And it's similar in the US and in lots of other kind of Commonwealth countries. It's derived from the kind of English common law, where you have effectively two teams, you know, a defendant team and a prosecution team, and they each present their case and they fight it out and they attack each other's witnesses and evidence and try and tear down the other side. And watch you all along is this panel of 12 random strangers picked out of nowhere who have to try and make head or tail of it.
Yeah.
And often we just take that for granted, but actually there's no reason why a justice system has to look like that. And in fact, it's more common in most other countries to have a more, what's often called an inquisitorial system, where you might have a magistrate or a judge who is themselves overseeing the process, and they call the evidence. They look at and they bring together experts and police and everyone else, and then they make a reasoned decision rather than having two competing narratives presented. And I wanted to know in particular, do you not think that would work better around expert witnesses? Because the very fact that you are literally being paid by one side or the other must surely colour the fact that you want to tell the lawyers who are paying you, in some cases, large sums of money, like what they're looking to hear.
Yeah, so the first thing to say is that not all cases in the courts in the UK are adversarial. So the family courts, which I've acted as an expert witness in a number of family court cases, where, for instance, the question is, have the parents been guilty of some kind of physical abuse or neglect of their baby or child, and should the social services remove the child from the parents and into care? And in those cases, what happens, the commonest thing that happens in the family courts is that they do instruct expert witnesses, but they are what they're called joint expert witnesses. So they would instruct a neonatologist, in my case, because it's a baby. They might instruct a radiologist who would look at the x-rays. They would instruct a pediatric neurologist if the baby had neurological problems, and so on. But what then happens is that you give evidence in court as a single expert, but you are then cross-examined by all the different parties. So there will be a legal team for the parents, there's a legal team for the social worker, there's a legal team for the child, and each of the barristers will then take their turn to cross-examine you on whether your evidence is fair and balanced and accurate. In other words, it isn't always adversarial, but absolutely in criminal cases, in civil cases, there is always a claimant or a prosecution and the defendant. And certainly in the past, there was a real, I think, concern that expert witnesses, as you said, could be, you know, hired to give an expert opinion which was favourable to the whoever was paying them. He who pays the piper calls the tune. And it was known anecdotally that there were certain eminent experts who could be relied upon always to give an opinion which was favourable to their particular side. and the whole system, I think, was in danger of falling into disrepute as a result of that. But in my lifetime, just over the last 20 years, the whole expert witness area has been massively tightened up, and in my opinion, improved, in order to try to ensure that experts are genuinely independent and they are genuinely giving an honest opinion.
And do you have to prove your credentials, your bona fides to the court, you know, to show that you're not just some schmuck that the prosecution has dug off the street, but you're actually a highly experienced, qualified neonatologist to be opining on these matters?
Yes, you do. You have to state your qualifications and experience and prove that you have expertise in this particular area, and you are told very, very firmly that you must only give an opinion on areas in which you are a genuine expert. If you step outside your areas of expertise and start to give an opinion on other areas, you will be subject to very severe criticism. So the way it works is a very English way, and basically in that you have to make these reports, which are first of all discussed with your legal team, but you're told very firmly you must give your own opinion, and eventually you present a report which is addressed to the court, and which has this very draconian thing called a statement of truth, where you say, you know, I swear that what I am have stated in this report is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. I've put nothing in this report that I don't have a firm conviction is true. I understand I'll be cross-examined on the basis of this report, and that I'll be subject to severe adverse criticism if anything in this report turns out not to be true. What happens then is that when this case comes to court, you are cross-examined in detail by the other side on the basis of your report. And sometimes it could literally take 2 or 3 days. You might have 10, 12, 15 hours in the witness box being taken through every line of your report, questioned, challenged. Why do you say that? What's the basis of that? You know, perhaps I put it to you that you failed to notice this, you know, and you failed to consider an alternative explanation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But then what happens is in the end, if it's a jury trial, the jury make a decision. If it's a civil trial, it's the judge ultimately makes the decision. But then the judge writes a judgment like this, with one we've just reviewed, in which the judge is instructed to write specifically about the performance of each of the expert witnesses. And so then the judge says in a rather English way, I did notice that Professor Wyatt did seem to be making tendacious claims which could not be entirely supported by the evidence. In fact, at times he did appear to be taking on the role of an advocate more than a neutral expert witness. And that then report is now in the public domain. And what that means is that from that point on, you are dead in the water as an expert witness. No reputable barrister will now employ you, because they know that if you then come to court again, the other side will say, I would just comment on this, what the learned judge previously said about Professor Wyatt. So in other words, there is a very stringent now method of quality control in expert witnesses. And what that's meant that quite a lot of people who previously did this work have disappeared and are no longer prepared to do it because of the level of scrutiny and stringency that you're going to be subjected to. So on balance, yes, it's not a perfect system. My experience is that expert witnesses in general these days strive very hard to keep to the rules and give an honest opinion based on their review of the evidence.
and the status of the lead expert witness, Dr. Dewey Evans, a neonatologist who the prosecution relied on quite heavily, was really a main focus of Letby's appeal and kind of challenge. And her lawyers basically argued, or tried to argue, that Evans, Dr. Evans, was not independent, that he was constructed theories designed to support allegations on the indictment rather than forming and presenting an independent opinion on the facts. And he had been hostile and emotive and dogmatic and biased, et cetera, et cetera. And also noted that he'd been criticized in a separate judge by a different judge in an unrelated civil case in the Court of Appeal around care proceedings. So it was a key focus of kind of Letby's appeal was the credentials, but also the kind of activity, the approach, the modus operandi of the lead expert witness.
And of course, the reason why so much focus now falls on expert witnesses is because the court is utterly dependent. I mean, you can't expect a judge to know anything about the details of neonatal care and about, you know,
the subtleties of skin discoloration upon air embolus.
So all the lawyers can do, they are totally dependent on expert witnesses who will honestly explain the basic mechanisms and who will then explain how they've come. It's not good enough to say, well, in my opinion, it's X, because the lawyer says, well, tell us why you think it's X. What's the evidence? What is your chain of reasoning? We need to see how you have come to that conclusion and how you haven't, why you concluded it isn't Y.
Because there's so much power, isn't there, in a technical, scientific-based, medically-based case like this. The doctors are the kind of gatekeepers, as you say, to a lot of the evidence, because none of us lawyers, judges, police officers, let alone jurors, are going to be medically qualified or trained to be able to assess this. And I was thinking about that in the context of, you know, there have been some horrifying cases where an expert witness has just got stuff so catastrophically wrong that they've actually been responsible for a terrible miscarriage of justice. And the famous case here is a doctor note called Roy Meadow, who back in the late 1990s was the lead expert witness in a famous case where a mother, Sally Clark, was convicted of killing her two infant children after she had two babies in a row die from a sudden infant death syndrome from cot death. And Roy Meadow basically very famously told the court absolutely unambiguously that the odds of this happening were 1 in 73 million. And, you know, one cot death is a tragedy, two is murder. It later emerged that that was just statistically complete nonsense. He's completely done that wrong. And as it turns out, we now understand that actually there are some genetic factors probably in Sally Clark's family, which made sudden infant death more likely. And she was eventually released after a few years in prison. I think Meadow was ultimately struck off, wasn't he, from the medical register?
Well, it was a very painful and complex business, because he was actually an extremely eminent figure in pediatrics. He was knighted for his contributions. He was widely cited as one of the great experts on different areas of pediatrics, and including the fact that parents could inadvertently or deliberately harm their children for psychological reasons. And therefore, when he was roundly criticised legally, he was at one point struck off from the register. He then appealed, you know, that this was nothing to do with his medical practice. Why was he being struck off the medical register? He was partially, I think, reinstated. But it was an extremely painful episode, but it illustrates the extraordinary power that expert witnesses can have.
Yeah. So kind of coming into land, I guess, stepping back from the to's and fro's of this case, and I think the overwhelming kind of feeling I had kind of trying to follow along from it is the sense in which there are just some unknowns that will always be unknown. You know, nobody was in the room apart from the baby that died and Lucy Letby. And so we will never know a 100% absolutely copper bottomed. There's no CCTV recording of her injecting insulin into a bag and watching calmly as a child dies in agony in front of her. you know, the court has been convinced, the jurors have been convinced, the lawyers and the judges are convinced, but there is to an extent a kind of lingering doubt that will always be there. And how do we as Christians in particular kind of deal with that? How do we, as people who have a very high premium on truth and on justice, how do we deal with a system in which we have to make decisions based on partial evidence, circumstantial, unclear evidence?
Yeah, it is very challenging, problematic. I mean, the first thing I would say is it is interesting, isn't it? Because, of course, we live in a postmodern age in which the many academics now say, well, truth, what is truth? There is no truth. You know, truth is invented by, you know.
You can have your own truth.
You can have your own truth. And there's Lucy Letby's truth, and there's the parents' truth, and there's the judge's truth, and the juror's truth. You know, this is just a myth. There is no such thing as truth. And yet it's interesting, isn't it? Because all of us intuitively saying, no, there is a truth here.
She did either kill them or she did not.
And this is where postmodernism, you know, great academic theory, but the courts work absolutely on the basis that there is such a thing as truth, and that it's possible for human beings to find out the truth. So I think, you know, that's number one, there is such a thing as truth, and Christian understanding of truth is that there is such a thing as a factual truth. You know, it's either true or it isn't true that Jesus rose from the dead. And the Apostle Paul was prepared to put the entire credibility of his ministry and of the early church and of the Gospels and so on whether or not it actually happened as a fact. So
most of the apostles, you know, staked their lives on it. And had their lives taken from them on the grounds of whether or not that happened.
They went to their death claiming on a truth claim. So the Christian faith takes truth very, very seriously. And yet it is interesting, isn't it? Because thinking about it, it's actually because of our very humanity, our creation made out of dust as fragile, limited beings, that sometimes we are never going to be fully certain of what the truth is. I mean, again, unless you were Mary at the tomb or Thomas in the upper room, do we really know for absolute certainty? Yeah. Can you prove that Jesus rose from the dead?
Blessed are those who believe but have not seen, as Jesus himself says.
Exactly. So in other words, interestingly, there is this other understanding of truth that is not so much a factual, scientific, objective thing, but it's related to trust. You know, in English, they have the same truth, trust, and troth, as in I pledge you my troth. They all have the same etymology. And so ultimately, the truth is what someone you trust is prepared to stake their life on. You know, those early Christians pledged their troth by going to their death, that Jesus had actually risen. And therefore, we as Christian believers ultimately trust those who've gone before us, that they were trustworthy.
And there's a sense in which human justice will always have a degree of incompleteness about it. And, you know, we've done our best with Lucy Letby. You know, we've painstakingly spent millions of pounds, the state has, gathering evidence on all sides, instructing experts and having hundreds of highly skilled professionals looking at all the facts. And we've given her multiple opportunities to appeal and to advance arguments. And we've come to a conclusion as the crown that she is responsible for these murders and therefore she should be given the punishment for it. But there is a degree of incompleteness because, as you said, we're created beings. We're finite. We're limited. We stand within creation. We don't stand above it. And therefore, we'll never have the perfect knowledge, the kind of total all-round 360-degree bird's eye view in which everything is known. And in that sense, that's why Christians leave ultimate judgment to God. We have our human justice system, but it's partial. And ultimate justice will come when Lucy Letby stands before the throne and God, who knows all things and knows truly what she did, and not just the things she did in the hospital, but what she did and said in her heart and her head, And that's why I guess we entrust ultimate eternal judgment and justice to the only one who can do that fairly, because they have complete, total, perfect knowledge.
It's very interesting. Yeah, absolutely. And in the Revelation, it talks about the books being opened, doesn't it? So it's like, you know, there are all these closed books and nobody really knows. But there is this hope that at one point the books are opened and what actually happened is the truth is now revealed. But I think it also means, therefore, that simply because of our limitation, miscarriages of justice are always possible. It's always possible that people are unjustly accused and condemned.
And I think the mark of a truly Christian justice system is one that admits for that humility and so has appropriate avenues for appeal. You know, it's, you know, what you should be suspicious of are systems where we, where countries boast of 100% conviction rate, you know, or where they take someone out after a trial and execute them 10 minutes later because we never made mistakes. You know, actually, it's mature liberal democracies, often in the Judeo-Christian tradition, which have developed elaborate appeal proceedings because we recognize, our anthropology says we can make mistakes, that, you know, just no justice system is perfect, and therefore we need to create avenues that we can appeal, we can correct, we can change our mind without
absolutely
having
the
lifelong consequences.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And I think this goes back, that's actually the common law root of the adversarial system, because the problem with the other one, the inquisitorial system, is as an example of what you get at the moment in mainland China, which apparently is something like a 99% conviction rate. You know,
Once the state charges you, you are by default guilty.
Yeah.
And the judge just rubber stamps what the state has already decided.
And there simply isn't that, you know, to use a flashy term, epistemic humility, the possibility that I might be mistaken. And there's that famous quote, isn't it? Is it Thomas Cromwell? I beseech you in the bowels of Christ, consider that ye might be mistaken. It's something I think should be written over every Christian kind of convictions when, you know, people bang the table. They're so utterly convinced of their rightness.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, this is potentially stretching a little bit, but in some sense, the inquisitorial system sets up the sole judge or the magistrate as a kind of god.
Yeah.
Even in a liberal, mature democracy, let's say what they have in France or Spain, for example, you know, the magistrate rules over the court, but doesn't just in the way that a common law judge does, but they also have the ultimate deciding power. They decide if someone is guilty. They decide what sentence it is. Whereas an adversarial system says, we're all flawed human beings. There's two versions of every story. Let's take 12 of your peers, and by trying to dilute all of our individual flaws and sinfulness and limitations, we can get a closer approximation to justice. But we're not going to abrogate to ourselves, to a single person, and set them up as though they have perfect knowledge and can decide once and for all who did what and what was wrong and what was right.
Yeah, it's just occurred to me that actually this belief in taking 12 ordinary people picked at random, at a kind of philosophical, theological point of view, that is a belief that every human being is made in God's image, that every human being has common grace, that every human being is capable of discerning right from wrong. It's a statement, isn't it, that you don't need to go through tertiary legal education before you can be trusted with the extraordinary question, you know, of guilt or of innocence.
Yeah. And I guess the final thing to say is, in the other way in which our kind of justice is partial, is that we are always looking forward to like perfect justice at the judgment to come. And that's both an encouragement for all those Christians who are suffering under the kind of, who've been unfairly or illegitimately imprisoned, who have been the victims of miscarriage of justice, is that they know that while this court may have ruled I did X, Y, and Z, or may have imprisoned me for my faith, I know that I will be vindicated in the eternal court, you know, that in God's judgment, justice will be done. But I think it also is an encouragement to us that this kind of period of seeing things murkily and having to weigh things up and on circumstantial evidence, this idea that we only have partial truth, partial evidence, we don't see perfectly, that's only a temporary phase, because we know that in the fullness of time, you know, in the new creation to come, when Jesus returns, we will be given that kind of perfect sight. We will be united into Christ, and there won't be any more doubt and questions and lingering concerns, and that will all be kind of washed away.
Absolutely. So it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think for many, the natural feeling is to think, you know, one day all the books are going to be open, is to think, good grief, you know, that's pretty scary. Do I really want all the murky details of my life to be fully revealed? Whereas actually in Christian thinking, it is, yeah, bring it on. Because ultimately this is what we need. We need truth. We need, and of course, along with that comes grace and forgiveness for all those murky realities of my life. But this amazing thing that Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13, now we see only a reflection as in a mirror, then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. It's one of those little clauses which just blows my mind. I mean, what Paul is implying is that just as I am the kind of level of complete knowledge that God has of me, is something that we will have, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known.
And still there is no fear for Paul there, but excitement. As you say, you know, so many of us think, well, gosh, wouldn't it be terrible if you could see into my head and you could read my thoughts and you could know my history? But actually, because of what Jesus has done, we can go into that throne room of glory and say, yeah, I am not afraid to stand before you, God, knowing that you see everything, because I am fully known and yet fully loved, fully forgiven, fully redeemed, fully restored. And we're going to live in that kind of radical, intimate, open, transparent, loving relationship for eternity.
Good stuff.
Right. Well, we've come a long way from Lucy Letby, but let's land there. Thanks so much for listening, everyone. We'd love to hear your own thoughts on criminal justice, adversarial systems, expert witnesses, truth and doubt and incomplete knowledge, and anything else that strikes your thoughts. Or if you've got ideas for other things we should be discussing on this podcast, news stories, medical research, studies, controversies, ethical dilemmas, do get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. So you can email us, MOLAD, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. Premier, I should stress, is spelt the kind of British way, P-R-E-M-I-E-R. No E at the end. You can also find lots of interesting resources on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. And you can find out more of my journalism on my website, tswyatt.com. And in particular, do sign up to follow my Substack newsletter, The Critical Friend, a weekly newsletter discussing church news. You can sign up via the website as well. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.